Well, welcome to the Kansas City Public Library. I'm Henry Fortunato, Director of Public Affairs. Tonight we're very, very lucky and pleased to have with us Demetria Martinez, author of Mother Tongue and other works. We really want to thank our partners at the Latino Writers Collective for bringing her here. Latino Writers Collective is one of our great partners, bringing us tremendous speakers throughout the year. Tonight, we have Shanet Carraza from the Latino Writers Collective, and please welcome her right now.
Buenas noches. Good evening, everyone. So, this is a pleasure to be here, and I just want to start by saying that words are power. And whether we are aware of this or not, the words are power. Demetria Martinez, a Chicana activist, writer, journalist, and a poeta, is a living example of this statement that words are power. Through her writing, Demetria Martinez has explored feminism, identity, and the creative process in and of itself. For example, Demetria portrayed the difficult journey of survival of two immigrant women from El Salvador in her very well-known poem, Nativity. As a writer, Demetria knows the great responsibility any writer has when selecting the words that represent us. Demonstrating the importance of selection of words, Demetria has said that as a witness of events many times, words are all that we have left. As adults, our minds are full of childhood songs, family recipes, colors, feelings, and fragrances, which we translate into words. These words have an impact on our readers. What kind of world would we have if we don't have any words, right? What kind of songs would we remember? Tonight, with Demetria, let's explore the questions of witnessing life's events and translating these events into words. Before we hear from Demetria this evening, on behalf of the Latino Writers Collective, I want to thank the wonderful Kansas City Library team for your valued support and participation with us to bring to Kansas City the opportunity of listening to Demetria. It is a sincere pleasure for the Latino Writers Collective tonight to introduce Demetria Martinez. Please, with no further ado, let's give a warm welcome to Demetria Martinez, or as I call her, la sacerdotisa de las palabras, the priestess of words. Demetria Martinez, welcome.
Thank you. It's a great honor to be here, a real pleasure. As you were speaking, I was thinking it's odd because I lived in Kansas City for 3 years, about 90 through 93, and it was a sanctuary for me. I had come out of a trial. I had been accused of conspiracy against the U.S. government to bring in refugees from El Salvador and was facing a 25-year prison sentence, and ended up going to trial. One of my character witnesses, my dear editor from National Catholic Reporter, Tom Fox, is here tonight. And I was found not guilty after being on trial on First Amendment grounds. We were focusing on the fact that I was covering the sanctuary movement, people who were helping Salvadorans enter the country as a reporter. And after that, after such a public life, all I wanted to do in the world was to hide under a chair when I got this call from Tom Fox at National Catholic Reporter, which is a paper all of you should know about based here. And he said, why don't you come out here for a year? And a year turned into one, turned into two, turned into three, which gave me a marvelous time to not only learn to be a journalist, but also to write Mother Tongue, and to know what it was like to just be out of the public glare and to enter into the world of words and imagination. And so I owe Kansas City a really great debt, and I'm just grateful for all of you being here. It's so funny because when I'm interviewed and when my works are written about, it's always these kind of heavy topics, you know, feminism, identity, mestizaje, you know, marginality, all of which has its place. And but so much of it can boil down to a story, something that's just really funny that tells us about who we are as human beings in search of identity. And for me, that issue always boiled down to skin color, because people would look at me and say, "You have olive skin." And I'd say, "What the hell is olive skin?" And so that set me off thinking about identity and history and the Spaniards and Native Americans and African slaves, the blood that makes up that of Mexicans, Mexican-Americans, Chicanas. So I'd like to read this essay. Let's start out on a fun note. This is called Lines in the Sand. Ever since the Spanish and the Indians mixed over 500 years ago, makeup has gone orange on Chicana complexions. Throughout my teens, 20s, and much of my 30s, I would emerge from drugstores, my wrists lashed with lipstick samples, my cheeks primed with blush, my jawline finished with foundation. CoverGirl, Maybelline, Revlon. I have graced cosmetic companies with more of my consumer dollars than I dare admit. But those mirrors at the counters that glare like headlights, take my word for it. They are part of a vast capitalist conspiracy against women with olive skin. As any Chicana will tell you, the one mirror that never lies is your rearview mirror at high noon. The traffic light turns red. You peer through dangling rosary beads, hope springing eternal. You just bought enough makeup to touch up a Diego Rivera mural. You ask not for high art, merely good coverage. But it is not to be. In the time it took to drive 10 blocks from Walgreens, your blush, lipstick, and foundation have taken on a sorrowful orange flush. The guy behind you honks. God only knows when the light turned green. The only reason to hold your head up for the rest of the drive is your eyeshadow, its colors fixed as beautifully as those in a Navajo sand painting. So what exactly is olive skin? My father is café con very little leche. Mom is peaches and cream. Why my coloring evokes the small ovoid fruit of a Mediterranean evergreen tree confounds me. For years, curiosity has lured me into gourmet delis and international markets, where I have scrutinized jars of olives and bottles of virgin-pressed oils, looking for similarities to my own skin color. Nada. I turn to the American Heritage Dictionary. The color olive, it says, is a yellow green of low to medium lightness and low to moderate saturation. What? I can't keep on throwing away money on makeup at Walgreens, I confess to Charlotte, an African American who works in cosmetics at JCPenney. Charlotte is examining my face like a surgeon about to lower the scalpel. You've got a ton of yellow, she says. A lot of my Hispanic ladies buy the wrong makeup because they don't think of themselves as on the yellow side. They think it's more of an Asian thing. She swirls a cotton pad in a powder compact labeled sand. Try this. Take the mirror outdoors and stand in the sun, she instructs. Remember, you want to match your skin, not lighten it or darken it. I forge ahead with this experiment in the blazing sun. Sand it is. Now this is a real discovery. 500 years after the conquest, this Chicana stumbles upon the perfect face powder, part of a line of makeup made for women of color by a supermodel who hails from Africa. Call it cosmetic justice. The Spaniards were enamored of the concept of sangre limpia, pure blood, yet their veins were saturated with the blood of Moors and Jews, African slaves, and the indigenous peoples of the New World. Is it any wonder that daughters and sons of La Raza Cosmica, indeed all Latinos, subvert the color schemes imposed upon us by census and society alike? One afternoon at a Chicago hotel, I was putting on my face in preparation for a poetry reading I was to give that night with African-American poet Nikki Giovanni. Listening to public radio, I was surprised to learn that the great physicist, Stephen Hawking, was speaking at a conference on cosmetology. I turned the volume up. Cosmology, you idiot, I said to myself. But I should have probed more deeply. The word cosmetics comes from the Greek word cosmos, meaning order. Such etymologies can seem esoteric until you turn 40. When my day came, I thought about the many cultures whose philosophies hold that physical beauty is a reflection of harmony, an order arising from good relations with others, nature, and the deities. My makeup expenditures took a prodigious plunge. Olive skin? Sisters, it's time to move on. Let's straighten our rearview mirror and press on the gas pedal. Another 500 years is just around the corner. Our little planet has an appointment for a makeover. We had better show up on time. We'll go back now and just give a little context. This I'm reading from my book of essays and columns. A number of the columns were written in my course as a writer for National Catholic Reporter. And this brief introduction, will kind of give you a sense of the book as a whole and the themes that interest me. A long time ago, I learned that if I were to stay sane, I had to jot down notes in the margins of the official story. The story is handed down in everything from church catechisms that are less than kind to women to proclamations of war that are making Earth a very unwelcoming place for all life forms. The margins are a great place to debunk, to tell your own version of the story, to imagine what a better world might look like, to rest up. Soon enough, you'll feel a tickle in your gut. That's not fear. It's desire to act, go forth and bless this mess, create a world worthy of being inherited by the poor, in which the rich are sent away empty. Of course, I brought to the margins a certain sensibility. I'm a Chicana, a Catholic, the spiritual descendant of Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz and César Chávez, Santa Teresa de Ávila and Archbishop Oscar Romero, Dolores Huerta, and Juan Diego, to whom Guadalupe appeared speaking Nahuatl. Like so many of my generation, I passionately yearn to pray and yet also to act, to divine what alchemical interaction of the two might grant us the wisdom we need, especially in the wake of the 9/11 tragedy and the U.S. invasion of Iraq under false pretenses. Hate and the threat of mutual destruction binds this world together as never before. Yet so, too, do mass communications and images of spirit that we share across cultures. Our traditional altars have evolved to include the Dalai Lama, Mary, Jesus, Buddha, Saraswati, and more. All insist that we never give up hope. Oh, yes, I'm a believer. But I also live with the knowledge that nobody has ever produced a photograph of God. So I am condemned to write from the edges of belief, often teetering into non-belief. But there is much to be learned, everything to be learned, in the murky nights of the soul. This is when I turn to La Llorona, the wailing woman of Chicano mythology who wanders the banks of the river, crying out for her dead children. There's no resurrecting the innocence we are acutely conscious of losing to violence early in the 21st century. La Llorona cries out, "Ay, mis hijos, my children," and I record her stark lamentation in the margins of official press releases about smart bombs and in the margins of banned photographs of coffins at Dover Air Force Base. What God, I add to my notations. But then, beauty breaks through. A young man working to stop the genocide in Sudan comes to me with a petition as lovely as any poem and asks for a signature. My niece declares that death is like mourning, except in the opposite direction. Look, there's Our Lady of Guadalupe in a Zapatista ski mask, hovering above millions marching in New York City against the war in Iraq. Time again to hope in a God who dwells not in heaven, but in such moments and people here on earth. Over many years, the notes I put down in the margins added up. I arranged them into columns and other pieces, some simple, some elaborate, all deeply personal, pillars rising into the New Mexico skies, the architecture of my place and faith. I'm no writer of manifestos. I'm a storyteller. As such, my job is to aid and abet, inspire and incite, refresh and console. I hope that you, the reader, will join me in an exchange. If something snags at your spirit, grab a pencil, go to the margins, and put down your thoughts. We're in this plot together, no matter how different our backgrounds and beliefs. Our stories entwine like trumpet vines. Together, may we break the spell of the official story and grant ourselves and the gods the open-ended destiny that is our right. The book is called Confessions of a Berlitz Tape Chicana, and of course I'm referring to the Berlitz language program and to the conundrum, the dilemma of my generation. Many of us grew up listening to Spanish. I'm sure this is, many of you have had this experience of listening to Spanish in your immediate family or perhaps your extended family, but not speaking Spanish. And so I've always been fascinated by the decision that people make, which I think is very spiritual, very political, not just linguistic, to learn Spanish later in life. And so what I'd like to do now is to read the title essay to my book, Confessions of a Berlitz Tape Chicana. We are everywhere, and it's time to come out of the closet. I speak of the tongue-tied generation, buyers of books with titles like Master Spanish in 10 Minutes a Day While You Nap. We're the Latinas with cassettes in our glove compartments. Commuting to work, we lip phrases for directing an Argentine cabbie to a hotel or ordering tapas at a bar in Spain. At home, we flip through catalogs of classes offered abroad. We imagine acquiring the language the way we might a wardrobe. But it costs. Tuition for language school, tickets to Guatemala, and a pair of Birkenstock sandals. It costs to be among the linguistic tourists my dad calls sandalistas. Yet how seductive, total immersion in a foreign country. So go the testimonies of our friends long after they've forgotten most of what they've learned. But we know better. We live, after all, in occupied Mexico and beyond, in every U.S. barrio and burb where Latinos reside. We show up with potato salad and tamales at raucous family affairs that make even funerals worth the tears. Here we encounter aunts with names like Consuelo, Elvira, and Mari, and uncles Bamba, Elfigo, and Juan. After lunch, they sink into couches and eat cake off paper plates. They speak a thick and sweet Spanish marbled with English. Total immersion? No place like home. Meanwhile, cousins cluster together and renew our vows to work at our Spanish. We grew up listening to the language, usually in the kitchens of extended family, but we answered mostly in English. We refer to our broken Spanish as if it were a broken bone and speak of how, when we least expect it, the language comes back as if it were a pre-existing condition. We are ashamed for something precious shattered under our watch. And we are determined. We want our children to achieve a fluency that we still struggle for. After my niece, Rachel, was born, I repeatedly recited the Our Father to her. Danos hoy el pan de cada día, give us this day our daily bread. I wanted to begin, day one, to open her neural pathways not merely to God, but to the Spanish language. My own education in Spanish began the first year of my life when my father was stationed in Okinawa. My mother and I lived with her parents, who daily crisscrossed the border between Spanish and English as they talked politics and poker. Later on, my father's parents took me to the church of the First Spanish Assemblies of God. Here, God made his glory known, not only in tongues, but also in Spanish, through the voice of a preacher who pointed at the Bible, thundered, and wept. My ears were opened. At dinners afterward, I huddled with my cousin at the edge of adult conversation. We knew what the grown-ups were saying when they switched to Spanish to talk about grown-up things. At home, on the telephone, Dad breezed in and out of Spanish, his inflections bending this way or that, depending on whether he was talking to an elder from northern New Mexico or an old buddy from the barrio. I don't remember my mom speaking much Spanish. An introvert, overwhelmed perhaps by my father's abilities, Spanish resided in her ear and not so much her tongue. The children in the neighborhood and in elementary school spoke English, with few exceptions. And so did the children on television. The Brady Bunch, the Partridge Family. Fifth grade, however, brought a surprise. A girl from Puerto Rico joined the class. We became friends. I flexed my Spanish, she her English. We firmed our linguistic muscles until one day she moved away. That same year, I wrote a paper that used a word my teacher said didn't exist. I'd always earned high marks for writing. Teacher said my comprehension of the English language was advanced for my age, in no small part, I believe, because my mother took me to the local library more often than to church. I pointed to the word in the dictionary. The teacher concurred. This incident seems important. It is still so vivid. That obscure English word, so obscure I can't recall it, was not only a word, it was a way. Command of the English language and its shadow side. Command over others. At the time, all I knew was the thrill of having discovered a word. It would be years before I would grasp the politics of the tongues in which we speak and witness the privilege heaped upon those who can wield English like a sword. On weekends, I spent the night with my maternal grandmother. She used to draw herself up to her full height and order, not ask, my father. Déjala, déjala, she'd say. Let her, referring to me. Let her eat that candy, stay over another night, jump on the bed, dirty the house. Dad shrank in silence. Grandma cast her spell with a Spanish word that signified unconditional love. My father was elected to the Albuquerque School Board in 1969, the first Chicano to hold this position. This in the wake of the passage of a landmark piece of legislation, the Bilingual Act of 1967. My father would enter the great debates of the day, debates that have never ceased. One camp saw the use of Spanish as a mere stepping stone to mastering English. The camp to which my father belonged envisioned the classroom as a place where a child would achieve fluency in two languages or more. Dad insisted I take Spanish when junior high and high school rolled around. I aced my classes. Your accent is perfect, my teachers purred. In college, I studied more, having tested into an advanced class. After graduating, I went on to read the great Spanish language poets, from Gabriela Mistral to Cesar Vallejo, in long ecstatic stretches every morning on the plaza of Old Town Albuquerque. I listened to the gossip of the viejitas as they emerged from morning mass at San Felipe Church. I yearned to ask them how long they'd lived on this 18th century plaza, how life had changed. But the tide of spoken English was too strong. By the time I translated what I wanted to say in my head, they had moved on. Yet with time, that yearning has gotten the better of me. I go longer and longer periods now conversing in Spanish, forgetting that I'm not fluent, which may be one definition of fluency. One afternoon, I found myself in the orange groves outside of Phoenix. Here, Guatemalan refugees lived under the trees until they could get a ride with a coyote to Florida. Churches brought meals. A mobile medical clinic rolled in. Exhausted women lined up. A nurse handed me a clipboard. "We're short," she said. "Can you do intake?" My lungs filled like sails. I asked the women when they had had their last period. I asked them about their journey. My tongue was untied. Another scene comes to mind. I am walking through Harvard Yard with a poet from Vietnam. "Beautiful night" is about all we say to one another before we fall silent. Then he turns to me and asks in Spanish, "Do you speak Spanish?" "Yes," I answer. "Where did you learn yours?" "In Cuba," he says. We talk on. Our words in Spanish are like pieces of a child's puzzle that we put together to make a picture of our lives. In 2001, the Salvadoran novelist Manlio Argueta invited me to his country for a conference on testimonial literature after the Salvadoran Civil War. He asked me to talk about my novel, Mother Tongue, which tells the story of a Salvadoran refugee and his Chicana lover. The book is set during the sanctuary movement of the 1980s, when U.S. citizens defied immigration law by opening their homes to Guatemalans and Salvadoran refugees fleeing a U.S.-subsidized dictatorship. I wrote out my presentation in Spanish. No problem. The legacy of the tongue-tied is that the unsaid often rushes with a weird ease to our hands and then to the page. Those years of in-class writing assignments surely helped. Yet, as in the orange groves outside Phoenix and in Harvard Yard with the Vietnamese poet, a yearning to connect had me fumbling joyously for the right word or even the next best word. Yearning cuts through the fear of the next best word, of imperfection, and it cuts through guilt and shame. Guilt crops up when we tell ourselves, "I'm Latina, I should be fluent." Shame follows when we're around the fluent and afraid to speak up. So powerful are these emotions that it does no good to know that much in our history has conspired against fluency, English-only movements being but one especially virulent manifestation. Who hasn't heard a story, recalled by elders or even contemporaries, of punishments meted out for speaking Spanish in school, from mouths washed out with soap to placement of Spanish speakers in classes for the mentally handicapped? And some of our own are our own worst enemies. The more Chicano than thou, more Mexicano than thou, intellectuals and activists who look down on the rest of us, perhaps because we reflect so explicitly their own struggle to find their voices. One evening I participated in a panel at the Smithsonian with Puerto Rican poet Martin Espada and Claribel Alegría of El Salvador. A woman in the audience stood up and accused, "How dare we speak as Latinos about Latina literature in English?" I have long maintained that Spanish is a father tongue, that of the conquerors. Our true mother tongues are indigenous languages, many wiped out in the genocide. I dream of a day when we Latinos are trilingual, or at least studying a third language: Quechua, Tewa, Yoemi, Diné, Nahuatl. The roads to recovery are legion. I managed to convey something like this, even as I felt a sword had been aimed at my throat. One of the protagonists of Mother Tongue is Soledad, godmother to Maria, who is the lover of José Luis from El Salvador. Soledad smuggles Central American refugees into the United States and dispenses advice to Maria about everything from life outside the law to home remedies. When she gets wind of Maria and José Luis's love affair, she counsels in a letter to her goddaughter, "Mijita, if you must lose your head over that boy, at least apply yourself and use the experience to shore up your Spanish." "How do you think I learned English?" "Remember that good-for-nothing first husband I once told you about? Well, we were young and in love, and what he said when we were together needed no translation." Falling in love with a man who speaks another language, you develop a third ear. First, you struggle to understand what he says. Then you begin to hear what he means. Then the relationship falls apart. But you are the better for it. She ends the letter, now write soon, in Spanish. And if you don't know a word, make it up. Awash in the music of Spanish, my generation grew a third ear. We fell in love with what we heard. That love drives us out of our solitude. I want to rediscover the secret of great speech and of great burning, writes Aimé Césaire in Notebook of a Return to the Native Land. I want to say storm. I want to say river. We tongue-tied possess the secret of great speech and burning. Tempestad, río, word by word, we're making our way back home. Thank you. I'd like to read a prose poem that I managed to smuggle into this book of essays. It's called When in Doubt, and for me it's become a kind of a manifesto about why I write, what we try to do, I think, often as journalists, as poets, when we put the pen to that horrible, blank, empty page that sits before us like an abyss. This poem is called When in Doubt. Your pen is a gavel calling the world to order. People come forth with their testimonies. At a book fair in Houston, an old man looks at you through smudged glasses and says, "Please, write that people in hospitals aren't getting the right medicines because there are no Spanish speakers there to translate for them." At a senior center, a woman says, "Write down that romero, rosemary, boiled in water and used as a rinse, keeps hair thick and healthy." Another says, "My mother used to sweep an egg over our bodies and pray to get rid of fevers. Write it down because the young people don't know." In the quiet of your room, you record the testimonies. You light a candle for Paloma Escobar Ledesma of Juarez. She disappeared, like hundreds of women workers there, disappeared. The police did nothing. 27 days after she went missing, her body was found on the outskirts of the city. Women around the world hold demonstrations and demand action on behalf of the disappeared women of Juarez. But too many times you walk away from the page to pour tea. But voices call you back. Grandpa Louis, author of corridos that were put to music, corridos about the beauty of New Mexico, a soldier fighting in the Philippines, an unjustly accused man, and civil rights champion, Senator Dennis Chavez. Your great-grandmother, Juanita, who wrote and read letters in Spanish and English for people in her village of Los Lunas, south of Albuquerque, she calls to you too. And you hear the voice of Grandma Lucy, whose students had nothing to write with. She cut wrapping paper she bought at Woolworth's and sewed it into tablets. She bought pencils, cut them in half, sharpened them, then gave them away. In the quiet of your room, in the clatter of coffee shops, at the anti-war demonstration with your reporter's notebook, in all these places and more, remember you are the daughter of Aztec scribes, known as the keepers of the red and black ink. Those colors flow from your pen. You write even when you are not writing. Fall asleep with your notebook and ink leaks into the page. A day or decade later, you recognize the glyph on the paper, and with a great aha, you set out to translate it into a poem. Years of stained fingers, the ink is working its way to your heart. You will die from writing. You write because you are so human. You fall in love the year that glaciers, for the first time in recorded history, melt and crack. You write a love poem. A long time ago you wrote, "Because we have no word for light, we live in shadows." Still, you persist in the hunt for that word. You search for more paper as the candle honoring the spirit of Paloma Escobar Ledesma burns furiously. You email friends in San Francisco, Vietnam, El Salvador, Africa, and Ireland. They know shadows. There is no burden too heavy for them. Poets all, they promise to search for the word for light in their languages and histories. They put pen to paper and call the world to order. I live in a war zone myself right now. It's called the border, the borderlands. We're seeing a very militarized border now. And what has happened is that immigration officials have sealed off all the areas that were easy to cross by foot or relatively easy to cross by foot. The policy is designed to force people to walk through mountains and canyons and lethal desert terrain and hopefully die. And it's working. The policy is working. We call it death by design. At least 1 to 2 people die crossing by foot from Mexico into the United States. This is happening primarily in the Mexico-Arizona border region. I've reported quite a bit about it, and so it's something that haunts me constantly. In 2001, in Tucson, we started a vigil for those who perish crossing the border, and the vigil, tragically, is still going on now in 2010. And I'd like to read this piece that I wrote for Latino USA. It's called "The Inherit the Earth." The Arizona sun is melting like a pat of butter on the mountain that flanks Tucson's west side. As the day dies away, people are gathering at an outdoor shrine known as El Tiradito in the heart of downtown's Barrio Histórico. For 50 weeks, every Thursday night, we have gathered here for a vigil to remember those who perish as they make their brutal pilgrimage across the U.S.-Mexico border. The shrine is little more than a ruin of a wall, its pockmarked adobes licked by candlelight. Legends have multiplied around the origins of El Tiradito, which means the castaway. Stories speak of a love triangle in 1870 gone bad, ending in murder, the body abandoned in the hard dirt. According to the historical marker, this is the only shrine in the U.S. dedicated to the soul of a sinner buried in unconsecrated ground. Unconsecrated ground. Reflecting on those words, I can't help but see our border, La Frontera, a militarized zone, a killing field. I think of the 14 men who died recently in triple-digit heat, abandoned by their smuggler, abandoned by a gluttonous nation that craves cheap labor but hates the laborer. Two, I think of the hope that guides such men, women, and children north. Only hope, biblical in proportion, would compel Yolanda Gonzalez on Memorial Day of 2000 to pour the last drops of water from her plastic jug into her daughter's bottle. The mother died in the Arizona desert. The baby, named Elisama, survived. To speak of an immigrant's plight only in terms of desperation fails to honor his or her full humanity. Of course there is desperation. Everywhere it uproots and drives masses across borders in swelling numbers. Still, whereas desperation drives people, hope guides them. With a patience that rivals that of Job's, the migrant gathers information, plans, packs, says goodbye to her family, then strikes out. It is not Disneyland she hopes for, but dignity. Perhaps it is such hope that consecrates the blistering desert terrain where so many have fallen. Even in death, excuse me, even in death, the 14 Mexican migrants live on as a sign. The forces of militarization will not stop a single determined soul from putting one foot in front of the other, plastic water jug in hand. At our vigil, we hold up a white wooden cross. It is marked with the word presente. Yes, the dead live among us, as martyrs, as prophets. Their lives, their hunger, and their hope add up to a cry that will be heard around the globe, a cry for change, a demand that we heal our tortured border, that we reconsecrate the earth. A lighter note, a heavier note, something in between. This is called Spirit Matters. It's a kind of a philosophy of writing. Writers are contemplatives. Daily we give ourselves over to silence, only to find the world at its worst marching across the snowy horizon of the page. The characters one had such hope for turn out to be, well, human. They hate, manipulate, seduce other people's spouses. They love money, worry about their looks, and fume about the state of the nation while making no effort to change a thing. This is not to say that grace does not happen in their lives, instances of beauty and truth, little epiphanies that unleash desire to live for something more, something the world's religions have named variously as compassion, agape, wakefulness, tikkun, the call to repair the earth. But all it takes is a traffic jam, a bad hair day, and my characters, those mirrors of my own heart, forget, entering once again into what Buddhism calls maya, illusion, or what Christians call sin. Still, the novelist hopes. We watch our characters without judgment, embracing equally what is lovely and what is sinister. We hope that in the end they will learn something about life and love. That is, if the darkness they court does not swallow them up first. At times, we try to push our creations toward safety and right action. But souls, even fictional ones, are not so easily manipulated. Like a parent, the novelist must eventually get out of the way so that characters can become their own persons and to enter into their own pacts with God and the devil. Chapter by chapter, our characters teach us that few people are wholly good or wholly evil. The writer who cannot love the color gray, who cannot embrace a world that is anything but black and white, will not last long. Our creations will die for lack of compassion if we replace truth-telling with moralizing. I'm not sure what any of this has to do with God or spirituality. Those words, bandied about so readily, frighten me even as they draw me like a moth to fire. I'm always amazed by the number of artists I know who once dreamed of becoming priests or nuns, myself included. It seems, however, that in reaching for heaven, we fell all the harder back to earth. The novelist is condemned to earth. We are called to be faithful not to abstract doctrine, so vaunted by organized religion, but to what our five senses tell us about the world around us. We may be affiliated with religions that preach a loving, all-powerful, and just God, but we are not God's public relations flax. In our writing, we must be willing to indict God, to tell the other side of the story. We tell stories as we find them, of the war veteran, the refugee, the diseased, the lonely, the insane. The novelist begs for an answer to the question, where were you, O God? We leave it to theologians to formulate answers. Our work is to stand in solidarity with those who have no answers. When our characters experience what seems to be the presence of the sacred in a moment of healing, heroism, cleansing anger, or bliss, we tell that story too. For who is not to say that the world as a whole is not struggling to realize a greater experience of the sacred. The writer's imagination must be roomy and supple enough for hope and joy, as well as gloom and doom. Our imaginations must be on call at all times, open to any possibility. So we fight sloth and fear and struggle to show up each day before the blank page. If a writer can be said to have a spiritual practice, this is it: to stay awake until the imagination stirs and music comes out of our hands. My hope is that by writing well, I will keep you, the reader, awake and in love with the human project, despite the tumultuous times in which we live. Thank you.
Okay, that was great, Dimitra. I think we have time for three or four questions. I do want to point out that our friends in Barnes & Noble have Dimitra's books for sale, and she'll be signing books after the event. But two or three questions, and then we'll call it a day.
After being indicted and gone to trial, my life is an open book. I have nothing to hide, so ask anything. Yes. I think the only theology that ever made sense to me was liberation theology. And I think that, you know, I was very politicized hearing the stories of refugees who were coming north from El Salvador and Guatemala. And they were fleeing a dictatorship. And what was their crime? Their crime was crying out for justice. Their crime was reading the Bible and seeing in the Bible the call to act for justice, to build the kingdom of God here on earth, no waiting for pie in the sky. And so to hear that articulated in the ordinary stories of refugees, and to see people like Archbishop Oscar Romero die at the hands of an assassin by bullet because he articulated that liberation theology, which really is just basic Christian theology. I think that's what was a turning point for me. And Christianity as a metaphor, if you will, makes sense. It makes sense in the sense that Christ bothered to suffer with us. If there isn't a God who suffers with us, then I don't know that I want anything to do with that God. And so I'm not a mass-going Catholic. I never met a religion I didn't like. My religious practice tends to be very eclectic. But when it comes to understanding Christianity, and I think as you correctly notice, the theological impulse that undergirds quite a bit of my work, I would say that it was my encounter with liberation theology in the 80s that accounts for that. But thank you for that question. A lot of people don't see how much at the core of my work theology is. Yeah, thank you. Preguntas? Yes.
I have a comment to make, not necessarily a question, but I lived abroad in Central America through Nicaragua more for like over 22 years, and my children were born abroad and were raised there, and most of the people, and I think it's something that most people don't realize here when we talk about two languages and growing up bilingual. I know in Europe and Latin America, the basic difference here, in the United States, when you hear someone speak two languages, people automatically think, or they kind of assume, lower class immigrants. Mm-hmm. And when you are abroad and you hear someone speak two languages, they automatically think...
Yeah, that's a good point. I've always been fascinated about the fact when you go to other countries, people are hungry to have their kids, you know, make sure that their kids learn a number of languages. And here we panic, you know, it's a sign of parochialism. We'll have to move on now to another question because our time is limited. But thank you for that observation. It's very, very on target. Questions? My life is an open book. Any questions about the trial? Yes, sir.
Gone to El Salvador and followed the reporting back into El Salvador. Has
The story of El Salvador continues. That's a very good point. And unfortunately, because, you know, with the media attention the way it is, we go from one earthquake to another to, you know, to this, that, and the other, and we never hear finally what happens. The last time I was in El Salvador was in, it was after, well, I said it in my essay, it was in 2000-something or other that I was there, so I haven't had any chance to do any reporting as to the state of the country now. I do know that our country is responsible, and I hope we have to answer before God for turning the country into a wreck by subsidizing military death squads and creating the diaspora that we created. But the other unknown story, the unwritten story, are many, many refugees from El Salvador passed through the United States and ended up in Canada. And I remember one Salvadoran said, but I don't want to. I don't want to go. I'll turn into a penguin. Who are the penguins? You know, how are they living now in communities in Canada? That's a piece of the story that I would love to explore one day. Final question? Yes. No, I'm sorry, I haven't. Yeah, I'd certainly heard about it. Very heroic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Other questions? Writing process. Japanese sword fighting. I do that. I know how to kill a man here, here, and here. and it's a perfect practice to teach you how to write, to be still, and to be aware, and to be awake. I'm a first person in the morning writer. Unless something really throws me off and life happens and sometimes we get thrown off, I like to get up and I do my Buddhist chanting, and then I go sit in front of the computer or pick up yesterday's manuscript and go over it. Yesterday I was really berating myself because it's been, I don't want to say how long it's been since I've written. And so I was in the Salt Lake City airport and I had one of my a short story that I'm writing. Part of a collection, a group of short stories about women activists living in Albuquerque. And I realized I didn't have a pen with me. All I had was the story. So I said, Demetria, if you are a real writer, this is the test, pull out your damn lipstick. So I got the lipstick and made smudges wherever I had made errors. If there was something that needed a little bit of an elaboration. So I had the thrill before I caught my plane into Kansas City. I had the thrill of saying, today I was a writer. So so no excuses. And I like to remind students, there was a poet, and her name escapes me, who was imprisoned in the Soviet, during the Soviet period. She was imprisoned. This is the way she wrote her poems. On a bar of soap. She memorized them, used the soap, and later came out with a collection of poems. So when people tell me I don't have a room of my own, say, go use the bathroom. there's always a way, there's always a place. One final question, and I think we'll close. Yes. Was mother tongue made up, or? I always take the fifth when I'm asked that question. All I know is in my 20s I was very good at falling in love, and I was very good at just living right outside the law, close enough to see enough to be able to write a novel. So, thank you.